morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning. And because we're live, we can interact. You'll need a telephone for that, but if you have a telephone, that's really all you need besides this phone number. The number is 800-227-5278. Oh yes, you'll need something else besides that. You'll need to have something to say. Now, what kind of things would we want you to say? Well, you can express curiosity. You can ask a question about the Bible or about the Christian faith or about your own spiritual journey, your own Christian life or whatever. Another thing you might have to say would be to raise a disagreement with the host on something that has been said, because after all, the program is not here to showcase the personal opinions of the host, although they will be expressed here. It's not my desire that it be the only opinion expressed. If you see things differently, feel free to give a call and do our listeners and myself a service bringing balance to the program. The number again is 1-800-227-5278. And I want to say that any of you who are going to be in the Las Vegas area this weekend, I'll be speaking again on the subject toward a radically Christian counterculture. In Henderson, Nevada, which is, of course, right next to Las Vegas. And information about that can be found at our website, which is thenarrowpath.com, at the link that says Announcements. And you're welcome to join us. That's at thenarrowpath.com, at the link that says Announcements. Ignacio from Los Angeles is our first caller today. Hello, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I had a question about morality. I'm having an ongoing discussion with an atheist friend who says that she does believe that morality is objective. However, that she says that it's explained through evolution, that morality is not based on either, not even socially constructed, that it's based on survival, that, you know, if one individual in society is doing something bad, then he's going to get cast out. So in order for him to survive, he might as well, live well with one another, treat the others as you want to treat yourself. And so those are the standards that are objective because evolution has brought them out. And that's how morality is explained. And I just don't know how to answer that as a Christian, that we believe morality is based on God instead of evolution.
Well, of course, what she has described isn't morality at all. It's just opportunism. It's basically saying that you want to behave in the way that won't get you thrown out of society. Right? And that means that if you rape little children, but you can keep people from finding out, and you don't get excluded from society, you've really done nothing that's essentially wrong. The only thing that's really wrong is for you to end your life prematurely and, put an end, make a dead end of your gene pool so that you don't pass on your genes to the next generation. There's only one goal in the theory of evolution, and that is to pass on your genes to another generation. And hopefully that the better qualities in your genes will lead to a superior race further down the line. That's what evolution is all about. It's about improvement over time by the preservation of positive characteristics through the passing on of certain genetic qualities. Now, the only way that human beings would have morality is if they are subject to something higher than simply the survival of the fittest. You see, if a lion kills another animal, we don't consider that to be immoral. Even if the animal it kills is one of the higher beings, maybe as intelligent as itself. If a lion kills a baby elephant, we think it's tragic, we feel sorry for the elephant, but we can't say the lion did an immoral thing. It's just doing what nature leads it to do. That's not immoral. And therefore, if we're just animals, like lions, and we feel necessary to kill somebody who's very inconvenient to us or whatever, to perpetuate our life, then that can't be any more immoral than a lion killing an elephant is immoral. In other words, there can't be any immorality unless it's just whatever is opportunistic. And evolution is opportunistic. Whatever perpetuates the species or the individual so that he can pass along his genes to the next generation is what's right for him to do. And if that's true of us, then killing people who are inconvenient, spreading our genes around through a whole lot of people, having a lot of sex partners and so forth, then that would perpetuate our genes. In other words, there is no sexual morality. There is no morality about killing. Because if there is for us, there would be for the animal kingdom. And no one applies it to the animal kingdom. We are just animals if evolution is true. On the other hand, if we are made in the image of God, and he's a God who has character, and he has moral principles, and expects us to be like him in our moral behavior, then that's a different story altogether. And the atheist doesn't have any real reason, except opportunism, to say that anything is morally wrong. In other words, they don't have any basis for saying anything's morally wrong, because opportunism is not morals. Morality is what you ought to do, because it's the right thing to do. Opportunism is what you want to do in order to look out for yourself, not because it's particularly the right thing to do. But then in evolution, looking out for yourself is the right thing to do. So philanthropy and laying down your life for others is not really part of evolutionary morality. So, I mean, you have to ask, is it always wrong for a man to rape a little girl? If your atheist friend says, yes, it's always wrong for a man to do that, ask why. Why is it wrong? And if she says, because doing that is, a behavior that will get him kicked out of society, well, what if he doesn't get kicked out of society? What if the society approves of it? What if he can do it and keep it a secret? Then is it immoral? You know, what is she going to say about that?
Yeah. I see. Okay. I think I have something to tell her now. Thank you so much for your insight. Appreciate your all of the stuff you do in this radio station. I learn a lot from you.
I appreciate your call. God bless you.
Bye. God bless you.
Our next caller is Helene from Covina, California, a town I grew up in. Hi, Helene.
Oh, hi. That's nice to know. Thank you so much for your ministry. I enjoy listening to you when I can. I am a born-again Christian, and I go to a non-denominational church, and I'm constantly seeking the Lord, and it seems that every time I think I know something, then something comes up and I'm confused. One thing that I'm confused about is the Seventh-day Adventist and worshiping on the Sabbath.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, worshiping on the Sabbath is just fine. In fact, I'd like to worship God 7 days a week, so I don't really see how the Sabbath becomes an issue, unless we're saying that the Sabbath is a day on which we're supposed to abstain from all work. That's really what set the Sabbath off from other days in the Old Testament. God said you shall do all your work in 6 days, and on the seventh day you shall cease from your work. In fact, the word Sabbath in the Hebrew means cessation or ceasing from work.
Okay.
So it's not really a matter of what day do you worship, since worshiping every day is certainly our privilege, and not on the Sabbath any more than any other day. Christians can meet whenever they wish, and wherever two or more are gathered, Christ is in the midst, and certainly we don't have to wait till a certain day of the week to do that. But,
all right.
The question about observing Sabbath will have to be a question of, will we do any work on the Sabbath or not? That is, are we forbidden to do so? Now, if we were living under the Old Covenant, we would definitely be required to observe the Sabbath. But the question is, what is the relationship of Sabbath observance to the New Covenant, which we know that Christ has inaugurated? Many people are confused about the relationship of the laws of the Old Testament and
yes.
Christians' role in the New Covenant. And almost all Christians, including Seventh-day Adventists, I think, recognize that the laws of the Old Testament, some of them are of eternal duration because of their moral character.
Okay.
That is, it's always going to be wrong to do immoral things. It's always going to be wrong to murder people or to commit adultery or to bear false witness or to dishonor your parents. These are moral issues. There's never going to come a time in history where those rules are going to change because
okay.
God doesn't change. The moral law reflects the character of God, and he doesn't change. and therefore morals don't change. But everybody acknowledges, and I think the Seventh-day Adventists do also, that there are laws that are not moral laws. They are ceremonial laws, like offering animal sacrifices. There's lots of laws about offering animal sacrifices, making pilgrimages to Jerusalem, and things like that. I think everybody who's a Christian recognizes that those are ceremonial laws and that we can't and are not expected to observe them today. There's no temple in Jerusalem, no sense going there. We can't offer animal sacrifices. And what Christ has done has actually put away, put an end to the legitimacy of animal sacrifices. In other words, Christ has fulfilled the ceremonial law. Now, the next question is, what laws belong to the ceremonial class and what laws belong to the moral class? Because all Christians, I think, recognize an obligation to follow moral standards, but not, and also all Christians agree that we don't have to keep the ceremonial laws, but the question is which laws are ceremonial. Seventh-day Adventists divide it up this way. They say that the Ten Commandments are the moral law, and then the other laws, which Moses wrote down with his own hand, are the ceremonial law. And therefore, since the Sabbath is one of the Ten Commandments, it's the fourth commandment, they say we have to keep that because that's one of the moral laws. Now, I don't know why we would say that. There's certainly nothing in the Bible that necessarily imposes that particular division. What constitutes a moral law is that it reflects the character of God in such a way that to break it would be a violation of God's own character. In fact, God could not have made the moral law different because he is not different. God could never say it's okay to be cruel because he's not cruel. God could never say it's okay to be unjust because he's not unjust. God could never say it's okay to be unfaithful because he's not unfaithful. So whatever God is, he could not command us to be otherwise than himself. And therefore, moral laws, or laws that are moral, are those that are rooted in the character of God, which he could not have made differently. He could never say, thou shalt murder, thou shalt commit adultery, thou shalt steal, because all of those reflect injustices, which God's not unjust, or unfaithfulness, and God's not unfaithful. But he could have said, instead of saying, make three pilgrimages a year to Jerusalem, he could have said, make five, or make two. In other words, that wouldn't violate anything in his character. If there is a law which God could have made differently without it violating who he is, then that's what we'd call a ceremonial law, and those are fulfilled in Christ. Now, the Sabbath law, that they should rest on the seventh day, is obviously a ceremonial law in that sense, because God could have said if he wished, I'd like you to rest every 14th day, or every 10th day, or every 3rd day. I mean, it would not violate his character. Now, I'm not saying that there was no good overarching reason for choosing the seventh day. He said it was because he rested on the seventh day when he created the world. Okay, so that was the basis of it. But all the ceremonial laws had some basis. The reason the lamb was supposed to be spotless is because it's supposed to reflect Christ. But that doesn't mean we keep offering lambs. The question is, would God have been in violation of his own righteous character if he had not given the Sabbath law in its present terms, if he had given it differently? Well, no, that wouldn't violate his character. And therefore, it is one of the ceremonial laws.
Okay.
And now, Jesus and Paul both equated the Sabbath with a ceremonial law. For example, Jesus, when his disciples were criticized for eating on the Sabbath, actually for picking and rubbing grain in their hands on the Sabbath in Matthew 12, Jesus said, this is like when David ate the showbread. Well, what did David do? He ate showbread, which was in the tabernacle, which was only for the priests. This was not a moral issue. This was a ceremonial issue. The tabernacle and the priesthood, all those things are ceremonial concerns. And so David broke a ceremonial law. And Jesus said his disciples breaking Sabbath was similar to that in principle. Thus, Jesus seemed to equate, Sabbath with ceremonial laws like showbread. Now, Paul did the same things in Colossians chapter 2, in verse 16 and 17. Paul said, don't let anyone judge you concerning what you eat or drink. He means the dietary laws given to the Jews. Or, he said, the observance of festivals or new moons or Sabbath days. He said, these things were a shadow for the time present, but the body is of Christ.
Okay.
The substance is Christ. So Paul equated Sabbath days with keeping other festivals and new moons and dietary laws, all of which are ceremonial laws. So Jesus and Paul both listed Sabbath keeping along with other ceremonial laws. But the Seventh-day Adventists say, well, no, the permanent moral laws are those in the Ten Commandments because they're written on stone. And because they're written on stone, they're permanent and moral. Well, that's not what makes a law moral, being written on stone. It doesn't matter what you write it on. The nature of the law is moral or not, depending on how it interacts with the character of God. And the Bible doesn't say...
I get it. Yes, thank you.
Okay, I appreciate
it. Thank you. God bless you. Thank God bless your ministry.
God bless you, too. Thanks for your call. And I just wanted to say, too, that I disagree with the Seventh-day Adventists when they say that the law written on stone means that it is, permanent. Because Paul talked in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 about the law written on stone. And he said that it was passing away. It says in 2 Corinthians 3, 7, Paul says, but if the ministry of death written and engraved on stones was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not look steadily at the face of Moses because of the glory of his countenance, which glory was passing away, how much, or how will the ministry of the Spirit not be much more glorious? And it goes on to talk about how this Old Testament has faded away, like the glow on Moses' face faded away, so also the Old Covenant faded away. But he specifically mentions it as the law written on stone. And so he's not differentiating, saying, well, you know, the law is written on stone. They're permanent, but the laws Moses wrote with his hand, they're not permanent. They faded away. Paul specified the law is written on stone. And so I would just say that, in my opinion, the Seventh-day Adventists are misunderstanding the nature of ceremonial law and assuming that the Ten Commandments make up the body of legislation that defines Christian holiness. It does not. The Ten Commandments define the holiness of Israel in the Old Covenant. The New Covenant has new laws that Christ has given. And, of course, they overlap, because all the moral issues of the Old Covenant remain moral issues in the New Covenant. Because morals don't change, because God doesn't change. His character doesn't change. But ceremonial things do change. And it says in Hebrews, there's been a change in the priesthood. And it says in Hebrews 7:12, there being a change in the priesthood, there's of necessity a change in the law. So the law has changed. Not the morality, but certainly the priesthood and the other ceremonial issues have changed. All right. Well, as you may have noticed, I don't give short answers, especially not when a long one is called for. And because of that, we had callers waiting who were not able to continue waiting while I gave that long answer. If you'd like to call, we still have about 10 minutes of the program left. You can get through right now. The number is 1-800-227-5278. You're listening to The Narrow Path, and I'll be right back after this word.
What is the proper relationship between the church and the dominant culture? Some churches opt for accommodation, seeking to attract unbelievers into the church by affirming and mimicking the culture in which the lost feel at home. Others advocate reforming the dominant culture by infiltrating the cultural nerve centers, politics, the arts, education, media, etc., and attempting to introduce biblical values. The first method results in the values of the secular culture invading the church. The second results in the church's values invading the secular culture. Neither produces anything distinctively Christian. When Jesus commissioned the church to be salt and light to the world, did he have one of these two approaches in mind, or is there a third alternative? In a 24-lecture series entitled Toward a Radically Christian Counterculture, Steve Gregg discusses a third alternative that he believes is more biblical. These these 24 messages detail the distinctives of the alternative society that the Church is called to be toward a radically Christian counterculture, as well as hundreds of other stimulating lectures can be downloaded in MP3 format without charge from the Narrow Path website, www.thenarrowpath.com. There is no charge for anything at the Narrow Path website. Visit us and be amazed at all you've been missing. That web address, www.thenarrowpath.com.
All right, and we're back. Welcome back to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we have no calls waiting. We've had the phones ring, but we haven't had any callers stay on to talk since our last call, that is. And so we have open lines. We've got about, 7 minutes left. If you'd like to be on the program, call this number, 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. I'd like to announce something to our listeners in Colorado who are listening to KLTT. I'm going to be speaking in Colorado next month, 2 days in a row, Wednesday and Thursday nights, April 11th and 12th. I'm going to be giving a two-part series, two lectures, on the kingdom of God. And if that's a subject that you've had an interest in studying or that you are curious about, feel free to join us at that. Now, I'm not going to give you the information right now where it's going to be, but it's going to be posted at our website soon. And so I'm going to just give you a heads up right now. If you live in Colorado, anywhere near Centennial, which, of course, most of the population lives not very far from there, might put that on your calendars, April 11th and 12th. I'll be in Centennial, Colorado. And the information, the exact information, will be found at our website before very long. I'm going to have that posted soon. Let's talk to, looks like, Komal in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to The Narrow Path, and thanks for calling. I'm hitting the button, but I'm getting no response from this.
Thank you.
There we go. Gotcha. Gotcha now. Hello.
Hello. Yes, sir.
Yes, we got you. We got you activated now.
Okay. So actually, my question is, I'm a Christian. My husband and I are really good true Christians, and my sister-in-law, my husband's sister, is not a Christian. So sometimes it's kind of being awkward around her because the things that she says we don't agree with her because we really believe that Christians shouldn't do the stuff that she does, you know, and mm-hmm. she just gets mad about it, and we feel sad because my father-in-law and mother-in-law gets mad on us because we tell her what not to do the stuff she does, you know. And we feel so sad about why we are being nice to her, and we try to be an example as a good Christian, and we don't get any credit, and we feel what to do about it, you know.
Well, you know, Jesus said, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth." He said, "I didn't come mm-hmm. to bring peace, but division." He said, "A man's enemies will be those of his own household." And so what Jesus was saying is the time will come when some of his mm-hmm. followers will have relatives mm-hmm. who are not his followers, and that this will cause unpleasant divisions between them. And it looks like you're experiencing what Jesus predicted. Now, as Christians, we need to learn how to relate in a friendly way with non-Christian people. It sounds like you're doing that. Mm-hmm. How much we allow them to say or do under our roof, for example, in the presence mm-hmm. of our children, is going to have mm-hmm. to be a judgment call we make, because Paul said that it's not primarily our duty to judge those who are outside the church. Paul said that in 1 Corinthians 5. He says, "What do I have to do with judging those who are outside?" He said, "God right. judges those people. We must judge those who are inside." So if your relatives are not Christians, then mm-hmm. you really are not in the position to be judging them, except in this, that they need to come to Christ. Now, when they come to Christ, right. then we can expect them to act like Christians. We can't mm-hmm. really expect non-Christians who don't love Jesus and don't care about Jesus, don't believe in Jesus, we can't expect them to behave like Christians. And it's not right. our duty to civilize them. It's not the duty of the church to civilize the unbelievers. It's our duty mm-hmm. to confront them with the claims of Jesus Christ, to do so in a loving way, to explain mm-hmm. to them why we are believers and why they should be believers, and what it will involve, becoming a believer, becoming a follower of Jesus Christ. Now, of course, that does mean they'll have to give up their sin, because you can't mm-hmm. follow Jesus and live in sin at the same time. But our focus
exactly.
with them, I think our focus with them should not be on their specific sins, but on their mm-hmm. generic sin of not being a follower of Christ. God can deal
right.
with them about their specific sins if they come around to Christ. And if they don't come to Christ, mm-hmm. it'll do us no good to try to reform them anyway. And so we just end up posturing ourselves as their enemy, and they don't like that.
Right, but is it okay to, like, leave it around them, or, like, it'll be, like, you just stay away from them because, like, they're sinning and you don't want to be a part of their sin, you know?
Well, you don't have to stay away from them necessarily to avoid being part of their sin, unless they're sinning in ways that would involve you in sin.
Right, right.
I mean, if they're speaking blasphemous, words or whatever, and you don't want to stay and listen to that, then
mm-hmm.
leaving their
mm-hmm.
company would be one thing. If they are privately, living in sexual sin or something like that,
right.
well, you being around them does not necessarily make you a sinner. Here's what Paul said
right.
in 1 Corinthians 5. 1 Corinthians 5, I think he gave these instructions. He said in verse 9, I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world or with the covetous or extortioners or idolaters, since you would then need to go out of the world.
Right,
he says,
right.
But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone, brother, he means someone who's called a Christian, who is a fornicator or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard or an extortioner, not even to eat with such a person. He says, for what do I have to do with judging those who are outside? Do you not judge those who are inside? But those who are outside, God judges. So Paul is saying that if someone's not a Christian, you can be around them. You don't have to follow them in their sin. Now, if you have children and you don't want your children around them, that's another story. You have every right to set standards for your home and to not expose your children to things that you think are bad for them. But when it comes to just being able to be around non-Christians without being judgmental, that is something that Christians can and need to learn how to do. I wish I could talk more about this, but we're out of time, and I'll be cut off here in less than 30 seconds. Thank you for calling. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name's Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593.